Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer of Northwestern University. The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. We gratefully acknowledge contributions to sustain the Infrastructure Show from Andrea and Ron DeFeo, Dr. Robert Peskin, and Dr. Raymond Ellis. Many of our podcasts have focused on constructing things like buildings or bridges, but times and circumstances change, and it's common to demolish structures to make room for something new. Structures are usually taken down piece by piece, but sometimes a quick reduction to rubble by controlled explosion is advantageous or even necessary. Our guest today is Mark Luozzo, who's president of Controlled Demolition, and he'll introduce us to the use of explosives to bring down structures quickly and safely. Mark, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
It's a pleasure. Happy to be on with you.
So, Mark, can you help us understand the right term we should use? People talk about controlled explosion, explosive demolition, implosion. Is there something that's a better term?
Well, it depends on what type of structure you're bringing down. My mother coined the term implosion with regard to explosive demolition back in the 50s. We started felling structures in the late 40s. And it was picked up and generally brought across the industry, but it doesn't always apply in that if you have a large building and you're bringing it in on itself, yes, that might be considered an implosion. If you're talking about a tall or slender structure like a radio tower and it's falling sideways, we refer to that as explosives toppling. But virtually anything will apply, quite honestly.
Okay, well, that sounds like it gives us some freedom to talk. Just how does this process work? Can you give us a quick overview?
Every structure that is raised above grade, every bolt, every nail, anything that was lifted up during its construction stores potential energy in that structure above grade, and gravity is always pulling on that mass. The principle of explosives demolition is to, on an engineered basis, use explosives, a very small quantity of the explosives, to release that potential energy, convert it into kinetic energy, and then, as far as CDI is concerned, our company, we use the mass of the structure and its framing to control the fall of the structure with something that is one of our trademarks called differential velocity control, or DIVELCON, having a structure fall at different speeds in different areas to control where the debris lands.
So to do that, it sounds like you need to control the timing of explosives at various parts of the structure very precisely.
We do, and one of the beauties of technology is it's always moving forward in a myriad of areas, and the explosives industry is no different than any other technical industry in that more and more refined timing devices are coming available on a commercial basis that are available to us worldwide.
Are there structures or circumstances that make this method of demolition the method of choice?
Whenever you have room that would be an area adequate to accommodate the fall of the debris based on the configuration of the structure, typically you're going to look first at an explosive demolition or implosion approach simply because it's so cost-effective. It's very fast. It minimizes the time for workers to work at high elevations, which is one of the risks that you'd like to avoid where you can. Gravity is free. That's something else about it. When you bring a structure down all at once, the dust from an implosion is the same quantity and type of dust you would get if you took the structure apart piecemeal. But rather than have that dust accrue over several months, you can get out of the way in a minute or so, clean it up, and that way there's less impact on the community.
So when you use the term cost-effective, so are there circumstances where it is significantly less expensive to use explosive demolition?
Typically, I would say where explosive demolition is used, it is almost always less expensive than the conventional demolition alternative.
How common is the use of this method in demolition of structure?
It's been very well accepted, as I've mentioned, since the late 40s when my father started using the method here in this country. We worked worldwide for decades, and it's very well received around the world. We have ups and downs. It's an ebb and a flow where often we will open up an area to explosive demolition. A local blasting company will try it. Things might not go well, and then the authorities will frown on it. But over time, it opens back up again for qualified people who know what they're doing.
So is there a lot of competition in the business?
It depends on what you define as competition. I don't think we have any competition in that most of the people around the globe who will try or will use explosives to bring a structure down are blasting companies. They started out in the rock blasting business, and then they drifted over thinking, well, I handle explosives, so I can do that. I've seen that on TV. Instead, we are an engineering company who focuses on demolition, who uses explosives as one of our tools. So we aren't a blasting company. We just happen to use explosives from time to time when it's appropriate.
What do you need to know about a structure to bring it down with explosives?
Need to know how much room is around it to see if you have room to accommodate all of the debris that comes down for this particular structure, because structures have different failure modes. You need to know what the circumstances environmentally around the site. There are certain areas where dust has to be finitely controlled, and you cannot finitely control dust from an implosion operation where you can on conventional demolition. So in that type of operation, someone may opt for a conventional piecemeal demolition operation to totally control dust, for example, at a nuclear facility. But other than having enough room, you're looking for structural information, if possible, as-built structural plans to determine exactly how the structure is put together. If you don't know how it's put together, you can't take it apart.
How common is it for you to find as-built plans for an older building?
Older structures, it's interesting. If you go back far enough, if you go back to the turn of the century, plans really are available unless there's been a fire at City Hall or the building department, something like that. Then there's a period of time, particularly during the war, where as-built plans aren't as available. They just didn't seem to keep them for whatever reason. Then as technology progressed and you get more sophisticated structural systems like post-tension structures, pre-stress structures, you find as-built plans being available again. So it's hit or miss, there's no question, but I need to point out that even when we find plans that are allegedly as-built, it's simply a place where we start looking. It's still incumbent upon us professionally and legally to make our own determination on how the structure is built, how it's been modified over the years, and how it will respond to what we do.
So you really need a hands-on inspection to know what's there.
Absolutely.
What kind of skills do you have in your organization to do this? As you describe it, it sounds like it's very much oriented toward engineering.
It is very oriented toward engineering, but we don't have a lot of engineering stamps here in the company per se, simply because where an engineered approach is needed in a given state, usually that state, the regulatory agencies, their property owners are looking for a local engineer stamp, for example, in California or Nevada. So you can't maintain stamps in all of those different states and different countries, of course. So what you do is you go in, use a locally well-qualified engineer who is hopefully familiar with demolition operations rather than just construction, and move along those lines. The focus we have is on understanding what it is we want to achieve. We do our own in-house design, but from a formal engineering stamped process, we use local engineers where possible.
It's interesting, though, the licensure process is really focused on building rather than taking down.
It is.
Is there an analytic piece to the work that you do, that is, for example, computer modeling to predict how a structure is going to fail?
We found that computer modeling isn't very useful in terms of the failure mode of structure, simply because you don't have good plans that give you the data that you need to input into those modeling programs. We do extensively use computer modeling for stress loading. For example, if I were working on a 1,000-foot chimney, such as the one that we took down not long ago in Georgia, and I want to see exactly what the stresses on the concrete are going to be. Let's say it's 4,000 PSI concrete. I want to make sure that as I rotate the structure and fell it like a tree, that I don't exceed that 4-kip capability. And using different available software systems, we can get in there and effectively use that. But beyond that, I don't like to rely on computer modeling because I think it's too easy to let the numbers fool you. Rather, we rely on historic data. We film everything, and now we video everything. We time it, we record it, and we use historic data more than anything else in designing future projects.
As you describe it, it sounds like you're having post-event briefings to figure out what happened and learn from that and go on to the next project. Is that fair?
The part of the job I like best is after a successful project, spending 4 or 5 hours plotting the debris path, looking at the debris profile, seeing exactly what happened as compared to what we expected to happen based on our historic data and our planning for this current project. That is where I think we really set ourselves apart from others in using the data to project it on future projects.
I think all of us have seen some of the videos on YouTube and elsewhere that show these demolitions in progress, but it sounds like you're using them for a kind of scientific analysis, post-processing.
We have no advertising budget. We have as much work as we would care to do. We look at a project and say, can we do it or can we not do it? That's the first step. If we think we can do it, then we ask ourselves whether we should or shouldn't. That's a commercial decision. That's a risk management decision. The effort that we make with regard to our video systems, where I'll have as many as 10 cameras on one structure, is to refine our knowledge of how structures fail. It's all about the data that we use moving forward.
So it's a learning process for you as well?
Well, it's a learning process because ever newer structures are coming down. In the early 90s, we started taking down unbonded tendon structures, structures that really hadn't been coming down because of their youth, if you will, in our culture and society. In Las Vegas alone, we've taken down more than 20 post-tension unbonded tendon structures. And you develop information about the newer technologies that are coming of age and are ultimately being replaced, either because a better system comes along or, as is the case in Clark County, Nevada, Las Vegas. There, things change quickly. I have taken down structures in Las Vegas that were only 2 years old because they know what time is worth, they know what money is worth, and if they want to change a structure, they do it promptly. So we have to change along with society, not only the society here in the United States and our culture, but also internationally. We have to be aware of construction methods, construction means, and we have to be able to move quickly and decisively to provide support where we feel appropriate.
Mark, when you deal with a post-tension structure, I would presume that as the structure comes down, the tension on the cables is released. Is that a particular safety problem, or how do you deal with that?
Well, the design tension in terms of the function of the force system itself is reduced, certainly, but that tendon is still there, and it has considerable KIP capabilities. So, as is the case with the post-tension parking garage we'll be felling in a couple of weeks in Colorado, there what we're doing is shoring on either side of the separation line, which happens to be near a pore strip. And then what we'll do is we will cut those tendons, the longitudinal tendons in the structure, but we then use those tendons as part of the system to help us control the fall of the structure by putting tension on the rear segments of the building to pull it away from adjacent improvements to remain. So actually, it was a learning process, I would say, for about a decade. But at this point, I am so comfortable with post-tension structures that I would almost prefer working with those than in felling cast in situ reinforced concrete. The tensioning tendons give you a very unique opportunity, whether they're bonded or even unbonded, to help control the structure.
Does it ever happen that your firm is called in to do forensic work to understand how someone used explosive destruction maliciously?
Not maliciously. We are often called to do peer reviews for others, and we do that not maliciously, but rather we try to maintain the integrity of the industry so that if someone wins a contract, they do it well, but we do it in a fashion where we're not giving them a leg up on the learning curve that we've spent 30 or 40 years generating our knowledge. We simply try to keep them out of trouble. We do perform forensic analysis on structures that have failed, collapsed due to poor construction, due to fire, due to catastrophic events, simply because when we design a structure for implosion, we know where we want the debris to go. If we come in on a project, what I will do is look at where the debris is, and then I'll back into what I would have done in the structure and what the timing might have been to cause the debris to fall in that fashion, in that location, in different levels. And then we can help other forensic analysts look at where the collapse started, and that helps them decide what the ultimate cause was and then possibly be able to determine ways to avoid that type of collapse in the future.
Without giving away corporate secrets, how do you teach somebody to do the kind of work that you do? I mean, I'm curious about what kind of people you hire and how you bring them online to be most effective for your work.
It helps if you're born into the family, number one. So nepotistic approaches is the easiest, certainly. With regard to someone joining the firm, typically we're looking for disciplines. We're looking for work ethic. I've brought people in from the construction industry. I've brought people in from outside the construction trades. Our field operations manager right now literally started raking leaves here when he was about 16 years old. But they come into the industry, and then we guide them through different disciplines. My vice president has a degree in construction management. My son just finished a degree in construction management. It's not the engineering I'm looking for. It's an understanding of how the industry works. And then we provide the insight with regard to our historic data to guide employees, to give them the opportunity to come up in the organization. That's one of the great pleasures that I have. I'm almost 70, and we just have a marvelous team. It's a lot of fun.
Can you give us a quick view of one of the more interesting projects you've done in the last 3 or 4 years?
Probably the most challenging project was one we finished about a month and a half ago in India, where there was a 240-foot tall continuous flow silo at a cement plant that contained pulverized limestone. They had a problem with the quality of construction in that structure, and they loaded it to its full capacity. And for whatever reason, there was a zipper failure in one of the post-tensioning tendons in the upper part of the shell. That zipper failure then caused the structure to sit down. There was a secondary zipper failure at an upper elevation, causing the top quarter of the structure to tilt backwards, but it didn't fall because the column of material inside these three segments within the shell were creating adequate support through skin friction to keep the structure in place. The cement company called in another blaster from Italy, tried to do something, didn't work well. In fact, it actually made the project more difficult because the segment of structure leaned further. But we went over. I spent about a day on site. They accepted our proposal. We had them install reinforcing walls inside the structure below the elevated slab where the aeration took place in the continuous flow facility. And at the end of that completion, which took about 60 days, we went in and dropped the structure and pulled it away from improvements to remain. Solving problems like that is the thing that I enjoy most of all, where you need to think a little bit outside the box, understand how a structural system is working, especially an unconventional load transfer system in a damaged structure. That makes you think very clearly and execute very cautiously. And when something like that goes well, it's particularly rewarding.
I can see that a partial demolition creates a serious problem because you've got to get back into a structure that may not be stable.
That's true, not only with partial demolition by virtue of things that are done by man, but also by nature. When you have earthquake damaged structures, structures that are damaged by fire, by explosions, whether it's a bomb or an industrial explosion, anytime you have a structural system that has been impacted to that extent, and you have what is basically a failed yet standing structure, meaning it's failed, it just hasn't fallen yet, that's particularly challenging, and the focus there, of course, has to be on safety of personnel.
To protect your people and to protect everyone else around, I assume, yes. Is the nature of the business changing? Are there different kinds of structures or settings that you're finding yourself working in?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the nature of structures coming down changes because you're dealing with newer and newer different types of construction. In the day, back in the day, if you will, when structures were still being designed by engineers sitting at a desk with a slide rule, which is what I used when I went to college, that was one thing. And if an engineer had to sign his initials down in that lower right-hand title block, it meant something to him. And there was a greater factor of safety in the structural systems back then. As computer-assisted design came into play and into the fore, we find competing industries, whether people are building structures out of concrete, whether they're building them out of steel, composite construction, they go for more and more efficacious structures with less of a factor of safety with regard to changes in the structural system itself. So if you have a post-tension structure, it doesn't take a great deal of impact on that balanced force system to cause catastrophic failure, which is why post-tension structures do fail progressively and create so much concern with building departments who are now dealing with demolition of same. In our case, with post-tension structures, we intentionally precipitate a progressive failure, but we control it with timing. So we play to the problem that a particular force system has from a demolition standpoint by responding with a benefit that we can draw out of that propensity. So changes in construction make a difference. Changes in industry make a difference. For example, right now, about 70% of the projects that we are working on or bidding or have pending are related to the fossil fuel generation industry, whether it's coal-fired power plants, oil-fired power plants. They are coming down right and left in this country primarily due not the carbon footprint, which everyone would like to think is being done for environmental reasons. It's just that fracking has made gas so inexpensive that all the power companies are using this opportunity to go to gas-fired units. And their older facilities are coming down. So there are a lot of things that change the demolition industry. You have to respond to all of them in kind.
Sounds like a really interesting business, Mark, and I appreciate your spending the time to tell us something about it. I think we can watch those videos with a little bit more intelligence in the future. Thanks very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.